It's time for Money for Lunch, where we feed your brain and your business with supersized portions of business and financial news. Now your host, Bert Martinez.
All right. I am excited to have everybody here, and literally mean everybody, our first guest today. We're going to just jump right into this. We have three very special guests that are going to be jumping in all at the same time. So it's going to be a lot of fun. Larry Shalita, who's one of our regular contributors. You guys probably remember Larry. Larry is the founder and CEO of Results Oriented Coaching and Consulting, an organization providing training, coaching, and consulting services dedicated to helping business executives achieve rapid and ongoing improvements in performance and growth. And let me tell you, everybody probably is aware of how difficult that is as your business matures and as the layers get involved. Also on the show, Jackie Bashira. Jackie is also a regular contributor here. She has helped individuals, including Larry Shalita, teams and groups transform their thinking and behavior for more than 20 plus years. Jackie is an evidence-based, results-oriented organizational development consultant and executive coach specializing in transforming learning, transformational learning and mindset recognition and development in group dynamics. Yeah. And then Barry Coleman, first time guest. Barry has over 25 years of experience as an organizational development professional, trainer, and facilitator. His background has included leading training teams, designing development, facilitating programs in a broad range of industries, including government, newspapers, financial services, insurance, and labor unions. Since becoming an independent consultant, his clients include Washington Hospital Center, PricewaterhouseCoopers, Howard Hughes Medical Institute, Department of Energy, Nuclear Regulatory Commission, National Institutes of Health, American Federal State, County, and Municipal Employees, and Sodexo. Ladies Fantastic. And gentlemen, welcome to Money for Lunch.
Thank you.
Thanks, Bert. Thanks a lot for having us.
You bet. So let's jump into this, and and we're going to be talking specifically about middle management. And so I want to start off by asking this very direct and simple question. Why middle management? What is unique about middle management?
So I guess I could jump in here and just talk about that a little bit, because the middle managers, one, are really the essence of providing leadership to the group that has to take care of the task, right? So they are the group that's really stuck right in there in the middle. They have to bring to life the vision and the mission that the senior leadership is hoping to achieve. So this is a very special group in that they need to actually communicate that vision, get people to work with that vision, and more importantly, get people to be successful. So that's that group that I consider the sandwiched group, kind of like they're like the lunch meat in between two slices of bread. You know, they're getting hit by upper management, and then they're getting hit by the people that are actually doing the work. So that's why I think this is such an essential group that we talk about, that we develop, and that we grow, because this is the group that sometimes gets either ignored, or the group that everyone points the finger at. So I believe this is the group that has to really carry the organization to success.
Absolutely, Barry.
Yeah, this is Larry.
For,
I have to
so
agree with
clarify. Go ahead, Larry.
I was going to say I have to agree with what Barry was saying. The middle manager is the one that has to translate what the upper management is saying and get the people who work for them to actually take the action necessary to make it a reality. The problem is that the people at the top look at them. If they side with the people that work for them, then they're, you know, pushovers, they don't understand, they can't get it done. And then the people that work for them look at them and say, you know, when they're representing the top, they say, boy, they're just a bunch of brown nosers. They just want to, you know, do whatever the boss says, really understand what's going on. So they are stuck in the middle, and they have very few resources to call on.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know what's also interesting about this group is that not only do they get it from both sides, but they're typically the first cut when a company is downsizing. They start, you know, they quickly go after middle management.
Yeah. There's a lot of truth to what you're saying there. And I think because that's the layer or the level that people or organizations think they can do without, when indeed that is probably your strongest group right there. So just imagine being a middle manager and being, first of all, sliced in between these two entities, right? And then secondly, being concerned about your job on a constant basis, because what we've learned through research, or I've seen through research, is that this is the group, the middle management group, that really suffers from not only depression but also fear, and fear in that, you know, they'll lose their jobs first and foremost before anyone else. So they are really dealing with quite a bit as that middle layer.
Jackie, you've been
I think something
quiet.
Else to
Any
come
thoughts?
Into play.
Well, I was going to wait for the for all the activity to calm down. So yeah, this is Jackie and I think in addition, though, to what you're saying is also they bring, in many cases, the stability of the organization. And so because they really translate what's coming from the top and help to lead and direct the technical that's happening at the lower layers, there's also a lot of opportunity to influence at that level, which is a strength of the middle. And so sometimes, one, it's being able to hear and understand what they're going through. So I was facilitating a group of middle managers a week and a half ago, and as soon as they felt heard and understood,
could you take him?
It really brought a new sense of life and strength. So I think that that has to be recognized in terms of the real strength they bring to an organization and can bring to an organization when you get them engaged. And that's the important element, I think, is making certain they're engaged.
You know, what's interesting, too, there is something that you said that I think most of us, if not all of us, can relate to, and that is being heard. I think that sometimes when we do not feel as though we are heard, then we feel ignored. We feel, nobody cares about us, or that our input is not important, and it diminishes our capacity, diminishes our morale.
Yeah, and you'll find a great deal of that, Bert, in that middle manager level, because they are between these two entities, right? That they get very little opportunity to really voice what they see and what they feel are the right things for the organizations, because one, they don't get to make the decisions, right? So they're not the decision makers. They are more or less the doers, or to help get it done. So sometimes they do feel that there's a void in their voice, there's a void in their value. And what you'll find in a number of organizations is that when people are new to leadership or middle management, they are very excited, because then they think they are really at the table and they can be heard. But then after they're in the position for, let's say, anywhere from a year to 3 years, they find that it's not quite what they thought it would be. And then they want to go back to being an individual contributor, because they think there's more support at that individual contributor level or that employee level, rather than support happening at the middle level, middle manager level. So I really do push middle managers to really support and engage with one another and talk to one another, because they really need quite a bit of support in that middle layer. So I always convince them, or really try to get them to move in that direction with one another, because there is not as much support there as you do see at the employee level or in the executive level.
You know, and it,
yeah, I'd like to add on to what Larry said. This is Larry.
Oh, go ahead, Larry. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to add on to what Barry said. You know, the staff, the upper staff, the upper management, they have their regular staff meetings. They're always talking things over and strategizing together, and they pass it on to the middle manager, who really doesn't have a support group or a group that they get where they get together on a regular basis. And then they pass the information or translate it down to the lower levels, where people are working in work groups, on lines, in work cells. So there's a certain satiance there. And the middle managers are left out. They have no one to turn to unless they start to turn to each other.
Exactly. And that's where they can get their support. Now, what is also important here, as we're discussing, is that there is a need for the middle manager to have a great example or good example in which to grow and lead from that manager above them. So I really talk to people about what has been your past history as far as people who you've led. Who are the people that have been in that position that's really encouraged you? Do you have examples in front of you? Because they also need to have good examples in front of them around leading, especially when it's their first time in the management ranks. So they need support in that area too.
Yeah, you know, what's interesting to me is after listening to you guys for the short amount of time is, you know, it almost begs the question is why would anyone want to be in middle management? Because, you know, it's one of those interesting steps, right? Because, as you said, you're getting kicked from both sides. You don't have as much support. But at the same time, there are some benefits there. I would basically call it maybe a large, what do you call it, big risk, big reward. But give me some of your insights from you guys' experience. Why are people, what do you call it, why does anybody want to get into middle management to begin with?
So it's really interesting.
Jackie.
Yes, go ahead, Jackie.
Well, so I don't know that I've ever talked to someone who said, my goal is middle management. That's my goal.
Mm-hmm. Right.
When I talk to people, what I hear is I want to be challenged. I want to have more voice in the organization. I want to be a leader. And so it really is a step in the professional development of an individual. So when I went from, as I've shared before, I did national and international news for the Associated Press. Before I was moved into management. So oftentimes you're good technically at what you do, then you're approached by, you know, a leader of the organization that says, hey, there's a position in management I'd like, you know, you to be considered for. And so it's really another step in the progression of someone's career trajectory. And then before I turn it over to you, Barry, to hear what you had to say, I want to perspective I also want to give is that I'm someone who believes, I think a little bit differently than maybe Larry and Barry do, in that I think every level of the organization has areas where people feel lonely, powerless. Like those at the top will say, well, there's nobody I can talk to. I can't tell anybody else the burdens that, you know, the financial burdens or the business burdens. People at the bottom will say, you know, I don't have any choice or say maybe over my schedule or how I do the work I do or what we do or how we do it. And so I do think at every level of the organization there are unique and distinctive issues and problems, but also rewards. So at the middle management level, you get to have your hands in the technical as well as in the strategic. So there are rewards there too, and I don't want that to be missed either. But in some ways, you definitely do have distinct challenges as you would in any. So, Barry, what do you think?
Mm-hmm,
I know
mm-hmm.
you were starting to chime in.
Well, actually, what you said in the beginning is what I was going to say, is that, you know, some people, they end up moving into this slot because it's career progression. Because I have not met folks who have said, oh, I want to be a manager or a middle manager. Many have, you know, as Jackie said, based on that technical skill. Yet what I do find is that when they are exposed to middle management, it's typically because they've had a really good leader. and someone that they look up to. And what they notice is that that person has helped them, and so therefore they want to help others. And they see that being a middle manager, they can do that. So it's not, in so many of the cases that I've witnessed, it's about money or about power. It's about, I will have an opportunity to help someone shape their future or their development, and I want to be able to do that. So I want to be able to do that and grow myself as a leader. So I always look at middle managers when I'm working with them is, okay, are you in this for the reasons of just self? Are you in this for others? And they always come back with, or the ones that are really thinking about this and strategic about it, is, I'm in this for both. I'm in it so that I can grow more into who I am and increase my self-development and self-awareness. But I'm also interested in helping others and helping to pull them out because someone helped me. So for me, that's a big benefit to being that middle manager.
Larry, thoughts?
Yeah, I have to agree with a little bit of what Jackie said and a little bit with what Barry said. I think that if you look at organizational structure, at any given time, any one of those groups could be the one in the middle. I mean, we're talking about middle managers right now, but if you look at the people at the top, a lot of times they're sandwiched between the organization or the middle managers and their customers or the shareholders. Who are demanding things of them, and they're being asked to translate and activate just like the middle managers are. I think that and so that does apply different pressures at different times.
Sure.
I think Jack's right. Having been in positions, you know, C-level positions in companies, yeah, sometimes it feels lonely at the top. You don't know who to trust. You think everybody's out to get you and things aren't working right. But it comes back to you have to put your trust in people. You have to almost hold back from being an individual contributor. Individual contribution is oftentimes gets you promoted, and it feels comfortable. When things start to go wrong, it feels comfortable to go back to the things that made you successful before. But those are the very things that if you do them, that will take away from the power of your people.
Yes.
And it'll be the first step in a downfall.
Yeah. That's such a great point. Oh, I'm sorry, Jackie. Go ahead.
No, that's good.
I was going to underscore what Larry just said there because I think that's an opportunity for so many middle managers. So those who are listening in is to really take advantage of the ideas and helping your people to express their ideas. Because of the folks I work with, those who are most successful, they utilize their people to help shape work processes, to help understand situations better. They use their folks in order to help the units to run better. So they don't go in as a manager saying, I know it all. They go in saying, we as a collective can deal with any situation, any problem, and resolve it. But I need the support of everyone. So I'm really underscoring that piece around, you know, listening to your people, understanding them, bringing them to the table in tough situations and circumstances, and really having them have a voice in the work that they get done.
And,
I like that.
First,
well,
this is Jackie.
This,
I wanted to
– go ahead.
So I was just going to say really quickly as a takeaway for any people who are in middle management is one of the things I think that we're talking about is learning to think differently. That when you're on you're on the front line or you're in a technical position, how you think about what you do is different than when you're managing a team or you're managing a group of people or managing a project or whatever that management is. And that's a process. Learning to think differently doesn't just happen because you've gotten a different office. That's a process that people have to go through. And I find that in my coaching. When I'm coaching people who are in the middle management position, we spend a lot of time talking about how do you develop strategic thinking and how do you develop team thinking as opposed to individual level thinking.
You know, and so that brings me up to this question, guys. When you think of strategic mindset or a technical mindset, which is the most important for a middle manager to develop? Give me your thoughts on this, and then give us the why behind your thoughts. Barry, why don't you start us
Jackie.
Off?
Well, this is Jackie. Okay, go ahead,
Jackie,
Barry.
Why don't you start us off?
you can tell by my radio background, the worst thing is to have dead air. So.
Yeah, no, but go ahead, Jackie, you're first.
So I think that the most important is developing the strategic, because most people come in already having an acumen technically. Now, the difference between middle management that you might find at the highest levels of an organization is you still are responsible generally for technical deliverables. But delivering a strategic mindset and how to develop people, I think, is crucial.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I'm with Jackie. Yet I believe you have to be able to do both. And so for me, it is really being able to see the tactical, so the day-to-day, yet leaning on your people to help you to really work through some of that, or leaving some of that to them, and you being able to develop that strategic mindset, not only around where the organization is going, but what you as a lead or middle manager want for your team. So I think you really do have to balance both of them and know when to apply which to a situation. Because in so many cases, some really fall into, some managers fall into that tactical, I have to know how to put the widgets in the box. And really, that's not your role. Your role is more or less how to help the folks who have to put the widgets in the box, how to help them to be more creative about how they do that, and then listening to them and getting them to help you to do that. So you have to be really thinking about both sides, and then when to apply either side in either situation, either situation. So, Larry, probably want to hear from you.
Yeah, I would agree with that, Barry. I think that you really have to have a balance. A lot of times, you bring in people that don't have the technical background, and you have to teach them,
mm-hmm.
or at least provide teaching for them, so that they can work efficiently and also safely. So,
yeah,
you have to have a certain level of technical skill, but you also have to have a certain level of strategic skill. There was a great samurai swordsman one time, centuries ago, Miyamoto Musashi, fought most of the masters in Japan. And one day they asked him, you know, which is better to master, the long sword, which is used to keep people at a distance, or the short sword that's used up close and personal? And he thought about it for a minute and said, you know, it's most unfortunate to die with one sword still in its scabbard. So you really have to have a balance.
Great story. I love that.
You can't just lean on one.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Just like they can't really lean on any one particular skill to be successful, right? So sometimes when we look at competencies and skills, some people think, oh, to be a manager, I have to be able to do these two or three things. No, you really need to look across the spectrum, because you need to be able to use a little bit of all these different skills in order for you to be successful. The days are gone where, as a middle manager, you get to sit behind your desk and tell people what to do. That is no longer. As a middle manager in this day and age, you are leading people on your team, your official team, then you have a project team that you're a part of, and then you yourself are a team member on another project. So you are wearing multiple hats, and with that, you have to use multiple skills.
Yeah, I think the middle manager is truly a catalyst. You know, their job, their responsibility is to help those around them, whether it's people working for them or the people they're working for. They have to help them be successful. That's their focus.
Mm-hmm.
What do we have to do to make these people successful? If they do that, they will be successful.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, I like that so very much. Yeah. And, you know, it's amazing as you guys are exploring this topic, how much is placed on the shoulders of middle management. They really have to be very
mm-hmm.
flexible, right? You know, they have to, as Larry said, you know, you're walking this fine line between siding with management and siding with employees and all this other stuff. So it's very, very, what do you call it, a very fluid dynamic area. And Brock with, as we said earlier, a lot of reward, but also a lot of risk. Let's talk about some key takeaways. What are three key takeaways for people concerning with middle management? What would you guys say?
So I know for me, this is Barry. This is for me, one of the most. So I'll give you one of mine, and then the others can certainly give you theirs. So for me, it's self-awareness. It's self-awareness around your ability to be just what we said: flexible, nimble, empathetic, listener. Those kind of skills that are really going to make you be a successful manager. So it is that self-awareness that you need to have coming into this game about who you are, because as a manager, so much is going to depend on your reaction, your response, your intent, your impact on people, that you need to be very self-aware. So I definitely will say self-awareness is the other. And then if I can flip it to the other side, it's also the piece around being self it's not being self-aware of others, but to be able to connect with other people. So it's important that you be able to do that, to be able to connect with the people you're working with, working for, on project teams, that you have those relationship skills needed to be successful. So for me, it's both of those skills that are really going to be paramount to your success. Self-awareness and relationship skills are key.
And this is Jackie. I'll piggyback on that, in that I always say there are three elements that are critical, and two are what Barry said. Knowledge and awareness of self, better self-management through greater self-awareness. The more you're aware, the more you can manage yourself.
Mm-hmm.
The second is knowledge and awareness and understanding of what motivates others, because not everybody is motivated the same. You know,
absolutely.
I might need or want praise. Somebody else might need or want, you know, more time freedom. Somebody else might want, you know, more say in projects. So knowing how to motivate others. And then the third element that I think is critical is knowledge. I call it systems thinking, that anything that happens in an organization, nothing is closed. We all impact and are impacted
mm-hmm.
by everything around us. So you have to have a knowledge of how the organization works, the processes, the people, how do you get what you need to get. So those are the three elements, I would say.
Okay, and this is Larry. I would add to it, I definitely agree with the self-awareness. You have to understand who you are. You also have to have an awareness of who your people are.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that there's a piece that we're missing that's called situational awareness, knowing what's going on around you, being aware of what's happening, not only technically, but with your people, with the organization. Mm-hmm. And then I think the last piece is being able to stand on your own and make a decision based on what you truly believe is right.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the hard part.
Yeah. It sounds like conviction to me.
Situation. Right. Right. If you're self-aware and you're situationally aware, the decisions should be they're not going to be easy, but they're going to be clean.
Right. It's a great point. Great point.
Well, I like that. I like that. Guys, this has been really a very, very educational. I hope that, our audience got a lot out of this. This could be definitely a discussion, an audio. Even you could transcribe it and have it as a nice little primer for those who are thinking about middle management, those who are currently in middle management, and those who are in the C-suite thinking about middle management. They can get a different perspective as to what's happening there. It's really a great primer for employees, middle management, and then of course C-suite. So I thought you guys did a great job. It's been a lot of fun to have you guys. Larry Shaliga, it's good to have you on the show. Jackie Bashira, Barry Coleman, welcome to our group. And guys, have a wonderful afternoon.
Thank you.
All right,
too.
Thanks,
it's a pleasure.
Take care.
All righty. Good stuff there from Larry Shaliga, Jackie Bashira, and Barry Coleman on the ins and outs, if you will, of middle management. A lot of that stuff I've never really thought about, but it's so true. They're called middle managers for a specific reason, and now we know why. You know, it's amazing all the difficult decisions that these guys have to embrace, right, all the stuff that they're dealing with. All the stuff that they have to deal with. So looking forward to having them back on the show real soon. And we're going to take a quick commercial break. But before we go, go to youtube.com/Burt J. Martinez and subscribe to my YouTube channel. You'll be so happy you did. I'll send you some free stuff, including I'll even pay for the shipping. And you'll also have a chance to become richly rewarded through my Amazon group, Amazon giveaway. Amazon giveaway. That would be awesome if you guys would do that. So in the Amazon giveaway, we are giving away Kindles, gift cards, some other Audible stuff, just all sorts of really great gifts to help your career, your business, and your life. Anyway, good stuff there. We're going to take a quick commercial, and we'll be right back.
Welcome back to Geico Radio. It's savings on the radio.
Cooler, Steve. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I just got a free rate quote on Geico.com. Saved a ton, and it only took me 5 minutes and 12 seconds. I was wondering, is that some sort of record?
That's a good question. Let's have a look.
Not quite. Someone's got you beat by 8 seconds.
Still, I mean, that's quite fast.
Well, what if I told you I only use one hand?
Geico. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.
All right, we are back. Rich Jacobs. Where is Rich Jacobs? Rich Jacobs is going to be joining us momentarily. Let's see. While we're waiting for Rich to show up, let's see. What else is going on? There's Rich. He's already here. Rich Jacobs, everybody. All right, so I was going to talk about creating a sales funnel, but since Rich is already here, we're just going to get the party started with Rich, and we're going to be talking about marketing. So we'll see what comes up. But Rich Jacobs, he's been a regular guest here a couple of times now. Richard Jacobs helps hundreds of attorneys nationwide to grow their practice using ethical online marketing techniques. Richard is the author of Secrets of Attorney Marketing Law School Dares Not Teach, and is a nationally recognized legal marketing expert and speaker. Rich Jacobs, welcome back to Money for Lunch.
Thank you, Bert. How you doing?
Man, doing good. I know you just got back into town from traveling to Italy. How was that?
It was great. I took my family on the trip. We went for a little over a week, and it was an amazing trip. You know, where I live in Austin, if you see something that's 100 years old, it's a rarity. And when you go to Rome,
right,
Florence, and all these places, everywhere is stuff that's 1,000, 2,000 years old. So it really gives you a different perspective on life, you know?
Sure. Now, so did you visit Venice? You mentioned Rome. What are the cities that you visited?
Yeah, we went on a guided tour, which I highly recommend. So we went to Venice first for 2 days, then Florence for 2 days, and then Rome for 3 days.
Man, that's spectacular. I'm very impressed with Venice because it's, and again, I'm not an expert, but if I remember correctly, they're kind of built on a swampland, right? And they're sinking into the ocean. And we've all seen pictures of the little boats, the gondolas that people use to scoot around in. But it amazes me how back, you know, when Venice was founded 1,000 or whatever years ago, with primitive tools, they decided, hey, we're going to build our city right to here, in the middle of the swamp. We're going to build it to right to here. And you know,
it's amazing.
Huh?
There's two other places that the same thing happened. One's called Florida, and one's called New Orleans. So it's not that uncommon.
I think you're right, but you know, but when you look at Italy, you can really see, I think, the effects of what's happening there. You're right. Florida is technically on a swamp. New Orleans, technically on a swamp, but I think that they had a better foundation to start with, and they've applied more modern principles compared to what was available, whatever that was, 700-800 years ago. So it's just an amazing thing. Like you said, you go to Italy. I have not been, but it's on our list. And you go there, and you see things that are, you know, 5, 6, 1,000 years old, and they're still standing. And in some cases, they're still being used.
Yeah, it's amazing. By the way, they're not sure the topic you wanted, but there's definitely marketing lessons I learned over there. But and I'll go quickly into one. So we had a tour guide, and he told us, you know, he showed us some buildings were really, you know, there was nothing left of them, like the Colosseum. There's very little left compared to what it was. And he said a lot of it was recycled because it was valuable. You know, there was marble, there was gold-covered statues, that kind of thing. It wasn't until pretty recently, you know, maybe the 1700s to 1800s, that any of this stuff was valued and kept. So a lot of things were torn down completely, reused, covered over, etc. But the stuff that wasn't was where they built churches. And some of the things like the Pantheon, it had to be rebuilt. I don't remember why. I mean, St. Paul's burned down, for instance, most of it, and it had to be rebuilt. But for instance, the Pantheon, the current version is at least 1,000 years old that's there. And the reason why it stayed is because it was a church. And you go in, there's marble, at today's rates, to do the inside of the Pantheon or to do St. Peter's Basilica, it's probably 1 million man hours of work. And this is all really detailed, intricate stuff. It's kind of amazing. You know, the economics today just would never even begin to support that, not even close. So it's kind of funny what was valued back then and what's valued now. But again, one lesson that I learned was funny is by making a given structure associated with a church or building a church there, making it a holy place, it was protected. Otherwise, it was used literally for scrap. And it's crazy that things like the Colosseum and, you know, big gold historical statues were used for scrap, but they were.
All right, so apply that. Okay, so what's the marketing lesson in that? Associate yourselves with things that are bigger and better than you? Clarify it for me.
I'm not quite sure on that one, but it just struck me that, well, one lesson is that it's funny. People will not value something that we would think is tremendously valuable. And other people would say, oh, that's, you know, that's a gold statue. I'm just going to use it for scrap. Meanwhile, let's say in the modern world, a gold statue like that to find, let's say, from Julius Caesar's time would be literally priceless. So it has a completely different value depending on the perception of the person. So I guess one lesson is, in your market, whatever that may be, you know, it could be attorneys or anything, you can have a perception of how valuable your service is or something you offer, but the market may have a completely different value of that perception. And obviously, who's right? Not you, the market is. So that's one lesson I would give is think about that for a moment if you haven't before. You know, you assume your product or service is worth this, it's really valuable, but it may not be to the market. Maybe that's why you're having trouble selling it, for instance. You know, or maybe you're right on target, but it's just something to consider. That's what that made me think about.
No, I think that's a great analogy. I think certainly since you and I work a very similar space, we've probably seen that. I think we've all seen somebody who's trying to market something. They've invested years developing it. They're very proud of it, and they're frustrated because they can't sell it. And the reason they can't sell it is because the market does not value it at the same level that they do. And it doesn't matter to the market that you invested 100 hours or 1,000 hours into it. The value is what they're looking at. And So I think it's a very, very good lesson that.
Yeah, you want a great lesson there.
Go ahead.
Again, if you look at inside of St. Peter's Basilica, it's four football fields of church. There's marble everywhere, gold. There's these mosaics that took dozens of people years to put up, like hundreds of them. I can't even calculate the value of everything in there. And again, it's probably literally a million man hours to do all that. People that are of faith may find tremendous value in that. People that are not may find very little or just tourist value in that. It's completely different for all those people, you know, and some people may think, oh, wow, it's amazing. It's worth, you know, other people may not appreciate it, may not care at all, but they're not your market. You know, it's funny that the Basilica, you know, for churchgoers, it's a certain market. For tourists, it's another different market, and they pay different prices and they value it differently. And then for some people, it's worth nothing, which is kind of crazy.
Yeah. Well, and here's the deal. Not only is it two different markets or possibly three different markets, but it's also the message is different. Because for the churchgoer, they have a religious message. For the person who's going there for the historical lesson, for the tourist, they have a different message. As opposed to people who are maybe artists or architects, they might have a slightly different message. So it's absolutely, I love that idea that, again, you could have, you know, your product can be valued differently, and then you could have different audiences for the same product depending on what the message is.
Yeah, and it tells you you need to have a message to market match, as, you know, a famous marketer, Dan Kennedy, has espoused. Because, you know, if you assume that the greatest value, let's say you own the Basilica somehow, you know, you're the Italian government. Are you getting value from the parishioners that go there? You know, what's that worth to you? Are you portraying it just in a religious vein, or are you portraying it for tourists? You know, and how much are they worth to you, the government, let's say, or to the country? Is there a third use that it could be used for, that it can be portrayed that way? And when you're marketing to someone, I found if you don't match what's valuable to them, they won't perceive value in your product. They won't be interested in it. You'll get no response. And that's all really your fault, because you failed to match your message to what the market really wants, your particular market. So that's another thing for people to consider, regardless of what they sell. It does not matter.
Right, right. And it's your fault also, because you don't understand who your market is.
Exactly. Exactly.
So I love that idea. I think it's fantastic, way of looking at things. Speaking of, let's say, marketing, and because you work with attorneys, I want to throw this at you.
Sure.
Because even though not our entire audience is made up of attorneys, this may be applicable to anybody who might be fighting the big gorilla in their marketplace. So let's say you're a PI attorney and you want to compete with the big guys on TV. How do you do that when you don't have those kind of budgets? How would you advise somebody who is the small guy in the big, you know, in the pond to compete with the guys who are advertising on TV? And, of course, you know, you can talk about it specifically from, let's say, a PI law firm point of view, but it's applicable to anybody who might own a restaurant or a different type of services, because there's always somebody who's two or three or five times bigger than you. So what is your thought on something like that?
Right.
How do you compete with the big guys?
My first thought is, do you even want to compete with the big guys? You know, imagine the life of a big guy. Okay, sure, they're getting tons of cases and all that. Are they getting good quality cases? Or because they're on every billboard and all over TV, are they getting a lot of tire kickers or people that don't want to pay a lot of money? You know, they may get tons of clients, but they may get tons of low-quality clients. Are they really
right. –
you know, if you have a serious accident, let's say, and you're, you're severely injured, and you look at the marketing put out, and you got one guy on TV or one gal on TV, and they're saying, oh, come in now, and blah, blah, blah. And then, you know, you're hurt, you have these injuries, how do you feel about even hiring a firm like that? Maybe you're repulsed by them. You may not know, but under the hood, here's what's going on. A lot of those firms, sure, they get tons of calls, but a lot of them are junk, and a lot of them are people that may not make good clients. You know, maybe they got into an accident, and they had just soft tissue injuries and nothing serious, and that's worth nothing to an attorney, unfortunately. You know, they want the real good cases, which sadly are like your arm was ripped off, your face was crushed, you know, your that kind of thing. So they may not even know their market either. They're just kind of spraying with a machine gun, you know, everywhere, and they may not be shooting with a rifle, you know, targeted type stuff. So it's actually pretty easy to compete with those firms because, first of all, they have huge amounts of money they spend, so they have to feed the beast. They have to get in a lot of cases in order to feed the $30,000, $50,000, $100,000 a month that they spend. You as a small guy don't have this. You don't have that overhead, which is great. So you don't have that fire under you that, you know, is going to burn you to the tune of $100,000 a month in expenses. Second of all, you want good cases, and you want, let's say, very specific ones. Maybe you want just trucking accidents or motorcycle accidents. There's guys out there that split the niche. They go into real specifics. Your marketing can be a lot more effective, and it's not going to be on TV. You know, let's say Attorney X spends $100,000 a month and they're on these five channels. I guarantee you the ad agency that hooked them up with those channels didn't tell them who watches those channels. Are people that tend to get into accidents that have bad injuries, do they watch those kind of channels? Are they older people, younger people? Are they wealthy? Are they poor? You know, what if it's like a channel where there's the Jerry Springer show versus another channel where, you know, they have, programs for more affluent people, and you get a completely different kind of customer. They haven't done any of that. These ad agencies have just said, hey, buy time on the air, you'll be everywhere, and we'll, you know. So there's a lot of honing and targeting that you can do that these big guys don't do. They just, like I said, shotgun blast all over the place. So, for instance, again, if you do motorcycle injuries, TV, I would say, is no good for you. Don't even bother. How about motorcycle magazines that people that ride motorcycles read, or online publications, or forums where people that ride motorcycles, Harley lovers, Kawasaki lovers, that kind of thing. There's all these areas where people that ride motorcycles tend to congregate. Advertise in those areas. Advertise on Facebook to people that own Kawasakis or Harleys or those kinds of things. So much more targeted. 1/100th of the price, maybe 1/1000th of the price. And if I own a Harley and, you know, a certain percentage of those people get into accidents, I'm going to need an attorney. So your marketing will work far better. So you don't even play in those arenas they're in. Don't look at them as if, I wish I could do that. It's not even relevant to you. This is the way you go. Go the complete opposite direction.
Yeah, I like that so very much, Rich. That's so very insightful. And again, for you guys who are not in the legal industry, maybe you're a surgeon, maybe you're a pizza parlor, maybe you're a plumber, and you're thinking, how do I compete with the big boys? Take what Rich just said and apply it to your industry, because your industry is the same industry as the legal industry. And that is, you need to create marketing that creates leads that you can get on the phone with and have a conversation with and eventually get them in the door so they can do business with you. So it's a different message, but more or less the same thing is happening. And I just love this idea of look at what the big boys are doing and then do the opposite. So if they're spending $100,000 a month in marketing, it's great that you don't have that budget because, it's you know, you might make the mistake of following them. In this case, you can be more resourceful, more targeted, and do something that's more of a niche. You know, if I was a restaurant and I wanted to go after a catering, who are you going to be your better catering clients? It's going to be CEOs or corporate events, and you can go after these guys, as Rich said, more cost effectively, not only doing a pay-per-click campaign, but maybe direct mail, doing just stuff that's different, that's going to make you stick out. So I love that.
Let me give you an example. Let me take you back to Italy. So You think the food is so great there, right? Nope. Every freaking restaurant was pizza, pasta, pizza, pasta, pizza, pasta. Same stuff. Right next to each other. So we were hungry, and you get pretty tired of eating the same thing. I would have given my arm for a French restaurant, for a Brazilian steakhouse, for, you know, and you think all these restaurants have to compete. Sure, you're in Italy, but hunger is hunger. They could have done so much better by having different stuff to offer. You know, not everyone, sure, everyone wants cappuccino and gelato and pizza and pasta, but that gets pretty old after a day or so. And I didn't see any restaurants that offered anything different, which was a major frustration. Same thing with the gift shops. Every gift shop, you know, my daughter said, oh, can we go into this gift shop? I said, look on the street. See the stuff in this gift shop? Let's walk. And we got to another gift shop. I'm like, look, the same stuff. Let's keep walking. Another gift shop. Look, the exact same stuff. I said, we'll get stuff later. They all sell the same crap. I don't want to get it right now and walk around with this stuff. It's heavy and, you know, I don't want to carry bags and all that. We'll get it later, okay? And she goes, okay. But, you know, the deeper message is there is why would I go to shop number 3 versus shop 27 or restaurant number 1 versus restaurant 9? They're all the exact same stuff.
That is funny. That is wild.
Yep.
That is just amazing to me that, what do you call it, that there aren't, like you said, a French restaurant or, for heaven's sakes, an American restaurant. I mean, think of all the American tourists who after 2 or 3 days of pizza and pasta would love to chow down on a hamburger again.
Exactly. Exactly. And that happened with gift shops. It happened with restaurants. And by the way, it happened here in America. You know, there's all the same stores. Let's say you sell a service. You know, have you looked at your competitors? Are they selling the same thing as you and you're just trying to compete on price? That's a losing battle. How can you differentiate what you sell? And I don't care what you sell. Your market is, it's all the same. If you're a dentist, you know, what are you selling? Can you do sedation dentistry or cosmetic dentistry? Can you focus on Invisalign? Can you focus on same day dentures? Can you, you know, there's differentiation in anything you do. Doesn't matter. Let's say you're a DUI lawyer. How can I differentiate? Well, I can handle first time DUI only or multiple DUIs only, DUI with accident, DUI under 21, DUI for drugs versus alcohol, DUI on federal land. It's endless. And again, even if you sell pizza, you could do Sicilian style pizza only. You could do, look at what Domino's and Papa John's does, how they differentiate stuff. They stuff the crust with cheese. They do thin, flat, gigantic size, square, triangular, different toppings. I mean, so if your business, no matter how boring you think it is or how commoditized you think it is, there's always a way to differentiate yourself. And just like we would have died for a hamburger, your customers, trust me, are maybe looking for something different instead of all the sameness.
Yeah, you know, it's so funny because I just did a video and I used the same analogy of Papa John's versus Domino's versus the gourmet pizza market that's now emerging. So you could go to Papa John's or Domino's, spend about $20 for a pizza, or you can go and spend about $60 on a pizza, on a gourmet pizza, right? So the same thing. You can go to Wendy's, McDonald's, whatever, and spend a couple of bucks on a burger, or you can go to one of these upscale burger joints and you're going to spend, $6-7 on a burger. What's the difference? And the difference is the message. The difference is how they differentiate themselves, the benefit that they're going to bring to you, because that's the thing that gets you in. That's when you say, man, I don't want to go to McDonald's, but I'm in the mood for a hamburger. Let's go to BurgerFi, or let's go to this other place. Man, they're a little bit more expensive, but their burgers are like 10 times better. And that's what we do.
Mm. Yeah, and one thing to point out that's real important, I've heard this a lot. A lot of people say, my customers are different. You know, they're cheapskates. They only want the cheapest crap, you know. Well, I mean, all right, so let's see some good examples. So let's talk about the hamburger, right? Some people only spend, they want the lowest quality stuff, they just want a dollar hamburger. $10 on a hamburger, you know, Angus beef or grass-fed beef or a hamburger with, like, all these amazing fixings, you know, a quarter-pound one on a toast bun. And spend $10, $15 on a hamburger without batting an eye. Different person. Who do you want to attract? Do you want to attract the cheap plates and the, you know, the low-ball dollar menu? Maybe you're doing that with your marketing. You don't even know it. Or do you want to attract the hot where you can make much better margin, and it may be, they may be better behaved customers and better customers for you. And in every market, those people exist. It doesn't matter what you sell. So you may be failing and say, oh, there's no margin in what we do. We're commoditized. We're giving you ways on how to get out of that. You should listen closely and never naysay and say, my customers are more educated, or my customers are this, or my customers are that. It's who you're selling to is also a huge factor, is what I'm trying to tell you.
Absolutely. Look, here's a great example. You know, Walmart has spent its lifetime and billions of dollars to be the low price leader, not the large profit leader, not the best service in the world leader, not the friendliest staff. Or as Amazon's new tagline is to be the most customer-centric company in the world. It's a different mindset. So do you want Walmart-type shoppers or do you want Amazon-type shoppers? And I love what you're saying there, Rich, because it's really in your message. It is so sad when you come across somebody who says, oh, my customers are all cheapskates. And I think that's really a reflection of them more than their customers. But you know, why would you want to work with a couple, you know, for a bunch of cheapskates that aren't going to want to pay you what you're worth and don't want you to have a big, you know, don't want you to have a profit? It's you're just starting off badly.
Right. Yeah.
All right. So let me ask you this. We're going to switch gears here a little bit from differentiation to I want to talk about, what did I do with it? Dang it. What do you see?
I think you mentioned the social media.
Yeah. Well, before that, I want to talk about what do you see are some of the biggest mistakes that law firms make? So before we get to the social media one, let's talk about some of the big mistakes you see law firms make. Maybe they make it in their marketing. Maybe they make it on their phone. Maybe they make it someplace else. But what do you see as some of the big mistakes that these lawyers or these marketing lawyers make, or just period, what lawyers make?
It's easy. The first one is because you have a law degree and you're a lawyer, that's meaningless. That's, you know, par for the game. That's the ante to get into the game. Nowadays, ante includes being an attorney, maybe even being a million-dollar producer or having 20 years experience or being aggressive or I'll fight for you or that kind of stuff or we care or free consultations. All these are just ante to get in the game. The average person, I mean, anyone can pick up their phone and they can Google, let's say, a divorce lawyer, San Antonio, and 10 listings will show up. They can look at maps listings. I mean, lawyers and everyone else by the web are becoming commoditized. Okay, so you got to stick out. First of all, a big misconception they have is, oh, because I'm a lawyer, they'll come to me. Or because I have 20 years experience, or because I went to Harvard Law, these things are important and, you know, clients will flock to me. Nope, not at all. Because I'm a great lawyer and I get great results, clients will flock to me. Nope, that's a terrible thing. None of these things really matter. It's very hard to stick out. The only thing that matters is authority. You know, have you written a book for people that are facing divorce in San Antonio, for instance? You know, have you how have you portrayed yourself on your website? Do you have a lot of reviews that show social proof that you're a good attorney and you're not just claiming you're a good one? Do clients really understand your marketing? Are you writing in legalese or are you writing in plain speak on your website? You know, clients have questions. They're not just going to call you right out of the, you know, right off the bat.
Yeah, I think that
website.
You know, again, there's a lot of insight for anybody in any field there. You could be the world's greatest surgeon, the world's greatest chef, the world's greatest fill in the blank. But how are you really separating yourself? Because to be, I like what you said there, you know, to be an attorney, you have to, you had to have gone and gotten a license and passed the bar, and people expect you to be a certain level of proficiency. They expect you to be good, just like they expect people to, be honest and to take care of their customers and all that other stuff that people profess to do. Assume that. And when you do all those things that they assume you're going to do, it doesn't even register on their radar because they expected that. They expected good service when they walked into your restaurant. If you deliver better than good service, they'll write a review about it. If you deliver worse than good service, they're going to write a review about it. But if they go in there and they get exactly what they expect, it's not a blip. It's what they expected. So I love what you're saying. First of all, you know, everybody has a certain cost of entry into the marketplace. And I like this idea of, again, differentiating yourself by having a book, having content out there in form of articles or videos. And, again, if you're in a complex environment like the legal world or the surgical world, speaking in terms that your customers understand is extremely important because I don't want to know – I don't want to have to open up a dictionary to know what you're saying, right?
Yeah. I mean, some of the things I see attorneys do that are big mistakes is they'll speak in legalese. The client, this is the first time usually they've had a DUI or they're facing divorce or their uncle died and they're looking to inherit and there's 10 other brothers and sisters that wants to fight them for the estate. Or, they're accused of a crime. They're in an auto accident. You know, people – they rarely get into legal situations in a given lifetime, which is good. Thank goodness for that. And they're scared. And legally, they don't understand. They're not a lawyer. So that's one problem. Another problem is lawyers think, if I give them a lot of information, they're just going to take it and do it themselves. No way. You know they can't do it. Then they'll never get as good a result as you. But don't worry about giving them all the info you can. They're not just going to take – it's a rare, rare person that says – oh, thanks for all the info. I'm going to go find someone cheaper. Bye. It's very rare that happens. It actually endears clients to you the more you give them, and it demonstrates your knowledge and, you know, you build rapport, et cetera. So my best attorney clients will spend 30 minutes on the phone doing the initial consult. They won't say, every situation is different. You just got to come in the office. I can't tell you anything. So that's one big factor right there. Another one's intimidation. People are scared. They're dealing with bad stuff. People come to lawyers, unfortunately, with bad situations. They don't come to them for birthday parties. So people are upset. They're frightened. They're worried. They can't sleep at night. You know, again, divorce, estate planning, DUI, criminal auto accident, these are all bad things, unfortunately. You got to help them. If you try to intimidate them and scare them and say, well, this is really bad, this situation. I don't think there's much that can be done, but, you know, perhaps I can help you. That doesn't work. No one wants to work with someone that's gonna be like that. You need to offer clients hope, always, always. You don't want to give them false hope, but you have to be positive. I'll give you an example, personal example. So you know those companies that say if you owe the IRS $10,000 or more, you know, well, I decided to shop these companies and see, and I called a couple of them, and you know I told them, oh yeah, I owe the IRS $50,000 or something like that, and. And they use scare tactics. They try to make me, you know, say, you know, you could – and I told them I hadn't filed in 5 years or something. They said, well, you realize it's a criminal offense not to file. And, you know, I really? And they try to scare you on the phone. You know, and the feeling I had at the end of the call is I don't want to work with these people. They're making me think doom and gloom. So same thing with lawyers. If you make the client feel hopeless, why would they talk to you? You're going to lose out to an attorney that will – blow sunshine up their ass, or at least one that says, you know what, your circumstances are tough, but I've handled many cases like this, and I think we can get you some kind of good result. I want to work with that person, not the one that tries to scare me. So that's another big one. So there's three right there.
I love that. I love that because you're absolutely right. Whether you're an attorney or whether you're hiring an attorney or you're hiring a caterer, you're hiring an architect, you're hiring a surgeon, you want to know that the person you're hiring feels good and confident that they can help you. If they don't make you feel good, you're not going to ever hire them. So I love those strategies there, Rich. We're out of time. It's always good to have you on the show, and I look forward to having you back again real soon, my friend.
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate the opportunity. No problem.
All righty. Good stuff there from Rich Jacobs. And I forgot to give out his website. And if you want to talk to Richard and his team, you can go to SpeakEasyMarketingInc.com. SpeakEasyMarketingInc.com. And Rich and his team will take care of you. As always, we're glad that you stopped by, and we certainly hope that we're adding value to your life, to your career, to your business. Give us a shout out on most of the social media sites out there, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn. You can find me anywhere. And, of course, YouTube. Go down to youtube.com/Burt J. Martinez. You'll be so glad that you subscribe to my channel. You'll get free stuff. Remember, you were created to succeed.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.